Good morning, everybody. This is Judith Acope. You're listening to Mad Love. Let's get into it. I'm pretty sure I'm at the end of my caregiving rope. Now my mom is just, she's just always awake. And the sleep agents that we use, like, it's just tough. I can't work full time and be up for any length of time in the middle of the night. Like, now, instead of just waking up and going to the bathroom, it's waking up, going to the bathroom, refusing to use the bathroom, walking back to her room, like, 5 or 6 times. I don't know how this has been going on. It started last week sometime, but it's like, oh, okay. And everybody you talk to are like, oh, yeah. Everybody you talk to is always like, oh, it's going to get worse. It's just going to get worse. It's a progressive disease. It's just going to get worse. Well, I can't do much worse. She'll probably wind up in a Medicaid facility, and it'll probably be before the end of this year, if not sooner. I cannot do this anymore. And I read an alarming statistic while I was up at 3:30 in the morning fuming because I couldn't go back to sleep. So by this time, it was probably like 4 or 4:30. Because we spent 30 minutes with her pretending like she was going to go to the bathroom and she never did. 40% of caregivers die before their patient. That's fucked up. That's a lot. And that's horrible. And I won't be one of those people. And the sense that stuck out to me is you have to prioritize your health over their comfort. And while I have done my very, very best, keeping her comfortable cannot be a priority to me right now. I'm a very youthful 54, and I would like to make it to 64 and beyond. I still got an amazing television show and movies and stuff I want to do, and I will not be able to do it like this. And she's a narcissist. She'll stick around forever. The mean ones always do. Enough of that. So here's my OJ take. Listen, I have a very dear friend who listens to this show. She's a prosecutor. I'm all for justice, but also you have to understand something. And I know that you'll think this is fair, Sheila. It's hard to comment on a case when you don't get to see the full case file. So I'm going to park that right there. There are things that a prosecutor and people who work in a prosecutor's office will have access to that will never make it into the newspaper. These little blurbs that they write, nobody does an investigative story on just a random shooting on a Tuesday in your city. But there are things that the office and people who work in that prosecutor's office and the police report and the police, obviously, that are going to see things that the public never gets access to. So let's park that. So here we go. Most people who know me know that I am friends with Arnell Simpson. It's not some crazy, wild story. It's not something I broadcast. It just usually comes up. We met at Howard University. Let's go back to Howard's campus in 1987. That's when I got there. Yes, I'm that old. My favorite record at the time was Sign of the Times, but Michael Jackson's Bad was out. You're doing wrong. Gonna get locked up. Remember the long video? Before too long, who's bad? Yes, 1987. So I'm a freshman at Howard. My roommate comes a week later than I do. I thought I would be without a roommate. So my roommate shows up, and it's Kim from Chicago. And so we hit it off. Turns out we have the exact same birthday. So she and I always, you know, we just hit it off. We got along. Right next door to us was a young lady named Musana Over. Musana was this really exotic, gorgeous girl. Like, every boy on campus wanted to be with her. They all knew who she was. She was from L.A. She was, you know, L.A. girls brought their own fashion. They kind of were the trendsetters on campus. And Musana was one of them. And so, long story short, the three of us become friends. Not through some exotic thing. We're just living next door to each other. Oh, Musana listens to this podcast. So, shout out to Musana. Hey, girl. So, anyway, we become friends. Well, one of her friends is Arnell Simpson. Musana has a very... interesting summer, our freshman year, she meets and gets herself engaged to Eddie Murphy, which people cannot understand because there's so many famous people now. But back then, people who were famous were superstars. Like, they were super famous and everybody knew who they were. There's somebody on YouTube that's a star right now and I don't know who that is. Okay, but back in 87, that's the way it was. So anyway, she got herself engaged to Eddie Murphy. In the meantime, she talked Arnell into coming to Howard. So I think sophomore year, Arnell visited. And I remember she was kind of grumpy and sullen, like, that whole visit. But she was cool, but she just seemed kind of grumpy. So I was like, whatever, nice to meet you. We were cool, you know, whatever, we're college kids. I didn't know she was going to, you know, attend the school at some point. So anyway, we're hanging out. Muzana, in the meantime, does not marry Eddie Murphy. And so when she comes back she doesn't come back for junior year, you know, which I don't blame her because the media people were chasing her around and I was hanging out with her. So me and all of our friends were like being chased around. And it wasn't paparazzi back then, but it was something. And it was stressful, and I was worried about her all the time. I'm like, these people, they act like you, Eddie Murphy. This is insane. And that's sort of when I started to realize that fame is like, it's weird. So anyway, Muzana's like, I'm not going back to Howard. Arnell's transferring to Howard. And she basically tells Arnell, like, look out for Kim and Judy. So that's how we became friends. I remember we went to an event, and me and Kim got a ride there. Kim had a car. I did not have a car. But we got a ride to this law school picnic. And the law school was like in a much nicer area, kind of closer to American University. And so at that time, it was much nicer. Howard has seen some improvements or gentrification, whatever you want to call it. And so I remember we were at an event at the law school and Arnell was like, well, I'll give you guys a ride home. And we get to her car. And this is, you know, I love cars. This was love at first sight. She was driving a Chevy Blazer. And it was the two-door one. It was so cute. And it was white. I remember that. And I want to say it had like some sort of tan interior. It was just the cutest thing. And I had never seen an SUV being driven like that. Like as a regular vehicle. And I remember we walked up and I was like, is this your car? And she was like, yeah. And I was like, oh my God. It was awesome. And I was like, oh, it's just kind of like a tomboy. Like, you know, that's something I totally would have driven. So it was very cool. We hit it off on that meeting immediately. The first meeting, she, like I said, a little grumpy, a little sullen. I don't know what it was. Maybe it was just she wasn't having fun. I don't know. But from that moment in 1989 till now, we remain very, very, very good friends. So just like everybody else's good friends, all my other friends, I've met their parents. And so I met her dad and I met her mom and I spent a lot of time with her mom. And, you know, it was interesting. I would go to the house. So fast forward, we graduated from college. I graduated a year ahead of my friends. Actually, I just graduated on time. No shade. But I graduated in 1991. I still very much wanted to make movies. I did not understand. All I knew about it back then was that I needed to be in LA. And back then you did. You did need to be in LA. So my friends graduated in 92 and they all went to LA. You know, the girls that were from L.A. moved home and Kim moved to L.A. So I call myself moving, but I didn't really ever have enough money or resources or I didn't have a car. You can't live in L.A. without a car. So I basically would wind up kicking it pretty hardcore and then running out of money and coming back. And I did that multiple times in my 20s. So over the years, you know, I remember there was one time, I think in the early 90s. Yes, let's get to it. So in the early 90s, it was 92. Yeah, I went out there. All of us were out there. We were trying to figure something out, get things going. We went to the movies all the time. I saw so many movies in between 92 and, Yeah, that 6 month stretch in 1992, I think I saw everything. We went to the movies constantly. And you would go to Arnell's house, but her dad was hardly ever there. I mean, he traveled constantly. He was always busy. I think of all the times I went to his house, I maybe saw him three times. You know, one time was to watch one of the Super Bowls that the Bills were in and they lost. One time was, I think it was Arnell's birthday, and he happened to be there while before we went to go somewhere. And he thought it was funny because I gave Arnell a copy of the Warriors movie because I knew she really liked it. So they sat up and watched it after I left. And she was like, my dad thought that was hilarious and a great gift. And then there was one other time, and this is the most significant time that stands out. We were having dinner, and this was the most time I'd ever spent with him. And he was talking and chit-chat like a dad would, right? And I remember he went to go upstairs, and it must have taken him like 30 minutes to make it up. I'm not kidding. It was a very dramatic time, length of time, because Arnell got up and was like, are you okay, Dad? And he was like, oh, yeah, just getting up the steps. And I mean, he was like stuck. And he didn't have to put on a show for me. I mean, I'm not anybody. So it's like he really struggled with his movement. And he had been getting knee surgeries while we were still at Howard. Like, he did not have great knees. So I always thought it was weird that he hopped the fence and just ran around. And I was like, that just doesn't seem like something he would do because of his inability to move like that. Now, that doesn't mean he wasn't abusive. That doesn't mean that he didn't do things he shouldn't have done to Nicole. We can't dispute that he was an abuser. But that's so much different than being able to run, hop a fence, jump over. I just never, based off of what I saw for myself, I was like, I don't know if I buy that. And I'll also say this. I went to a party. So Arnell was close to Nicole, because she was close to the kids, and she loved her younger brother and sister. And so she had a rapport with Nicole. And I remember I met Nicole. We got to her house. It was like 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And this is the truth. We pull up, and you know, I love cars. We pull up to her house, and the garage is in the front, and the door is up, and haphazardly, like someone parked it drunk. It's like a Ferrari. It was I want to say it was a Ferrari in the garage. It was a very expensive car, and it was haphazardly parked. And I was like, that's not great. I would be very upset if someone parked my Ferrari or Lamborghini or whatever like that. But I'm fairly certain it was a Ferrari. And so we get in the house, and Nicole's sunbathing. She had on a bathing suit, and I met her and I saw her body because she had it out. And I was like, that lady was fit. I mean, really fit. And I just had a hard time believing he could run up in the darkness on her and another younger person and murder them in no time flat. And then, you know, so I just didn't believe that, based off of the things that I had seen for myself. I've never read the police report. I've never seen the prosecutor's documents. All of these are just observations that I've seen for myself. While I'm meeting Nicole, there's a blonde man walking very quickly back and forth from the pool house to the main house. Back and forth, back and forth. Turns out that's Cato Kalin. I encountered him probably more than OJ, because he was living at OJ's house at one point as well. So in between my encounters with him, he went from living with Nicole to living with OJ. So when he's at Nicole's house this particular time, I'm like, Arnell, who is this man that keeps running back and forth really quickly, by the way? And she's like, oh, that's Cato, girl. He take care of the kids. I was like, that guy? That guy takes care of kids. I found him to be a super fast talking, he just seemed like a cocaine addict to me. He seemed like he was completely on drugs. And I went to a party at that same house where the Ferrari or whatever supercar was parked weird. I went to a party with Arnell at that house. And it felt like the majority of the people who were there, including Kris Jenner and Bruce Jenner. Bruce seemed very sad. Now I get that he probably wanted to be a woman. I met him. I met Kris. It was a lot of people there at that party. Marcus Allen was at that party. I can't remember who else. But they all seemed like they probably were about to do some drugs or had been doing drugs or something. And I left D.C. so in the 90s. So I was very attuned to drugs and what people who were on drugs acted like. And I was never a drug girl. So there was a black bartender at this particular party, and he was from Kansas City. So I was, and I'm telling you, they had a full bar. It looked like a bar in a restaurant or a club, and it was all top shelf liquor, and it was huge, the big bottles, like they get down. So I walk up to him and I'm like, whoa, this is, do you do these kind of parties often? I mean, I'm just chit chatting with him. We find out we're both from Missouri. And he was like, oh, yeah, yeah, I do this at least once a month, something like that, very frequently. Now, this is an old memory. So bear with me. I don't remember 100% all the details. I mainly remember impressions. And he goes, yeah, but I remember this, though. He said, yeah, she does this about once a month. And I said, man, this is all top shelf liquor. He was like, yeah, she don't spare no expense. And I was like, okay. And so she has a lot of parties. She was living a really good life. And I'm not victim blaming or anything. They had what they had. I don't comment on people's marriages. Like, they had what they had. All I know is whatever it was, they both had it for each other. Toxic. They seemed to both be addicted to the toxicity of this relationship. Because almost everybody OJ would talk to was at this party. It's like, you know, I was there because of Arnell. And what was weird to me is I'm from St. Louis. So at some point, somebody gonna be like, who did you come with? I don't know you. Who are you? You know what I mean? Like, none of these people were like that. How do you know Nicole? Like, they didn't seem to care. They all just were like, you look all right. Okay. So that's how you can infiltrate their world. These people, you would think they would just, if you look decent enough, they just let you in. Like, if you look cool, you clean, you kind of cute, whatever, you can just float into their lives. That's how they met Cato Kaelin. He was on a ski trip in Aspen with them. And sort of like, I guess they said, if you come out to LA, just look us up. And he did. So that's weird. I just found all of it weird and strange. And Arnell and I think we had our first conversation about this maybe 5 years ago. We just never talked about it. I know she didn't think her father did it. And I don't think he did it, but it's based off of the things that I saw. Do I think he knows more than he's telling? Than he ever told? Probably. Yeah. But I don't think it's because he ran up on them. I don't think he physically could have done that. And I don't think he would have done that. I think he would have hired somebody to do it, to be honest with you. Because that's what a really sinister rich person would do. They wouldn't go do it themselves. And I get this crime of passion thing, but I didn't feel that from them. I didn't feel that from them. And I'm not God. I'm not psychic. I wasn't there. This is just all based off things I saw for myself. I thought they all did a lot of drugs. They all seemed to have this pretty lavish life that I was not familiar with. The other thing is, there's a man who confessed to the murder. He was a drifter. I saw a whole show on him because Kim told me about it. Glenn somebody. His name just flew out of my mind. It's Glenn something. But he says he murdered Nicole because, and I'll tell you why this theory might hold some weight too, because he was hired to be a handyman. And I just told you, they don't vet people. They didn't vet people. I'm just wandering around Nicole's little mini mansion and no one's saying a word I think it was the Gretna Greenhouse. I think it was a condo. I'm not sure. It wasn't the one she was murdered in. It was the Gretna Green place. And so I'm just there. No one's asking any questions. There's tons of food, drink. People are partying. They don't vet people. So I'm pretty sure if this guy was like, I can do handiwork for you, I'm sure they, OJ was like, okay, because they didn't vet people. So he says he murdered Nicole because the, and I don't know if this was in a documentary, if this is just something Kim knew, I don't know. But apparently he was hired by OJ to go into the house to retrieve a very expensive pair of earrings that he had given Nicole and he wanted them back. That really sounds on brand. And then this guy, you know, he was a professional murderer. So he killed people. This was like his fourth murder that he confessed to. So there's that, which holds water based off of the things I know about these people personally. I don't know what happened. I wasn't there. But like I said, they don't vet people. They didn't vet people. They just sort of let people wander in and out of their lives. It was strange to me. And it was long before I was a kid. I was like 22. And I was like, what? So that was weird. And then also, the thing. So if this is true. So if they had Colombian neckties, OJ didn't know how to do that. I'm sorry. Just because you're famous doesn't mean you know how to do everything. Now, it's one thing to sever someone's neck, but if this is true, there's reports that they both had Colombian neckties. That's professional. I'm sorry. You kill people for a living if you can do that. If you can slice someone's throat open and pull out their tongue, you are a killer. Professionally. And I don't believe that he was. And I, without being able to see the file, the case file and the police report, if that's true, then I definitely think he should have been excluded immediately. These are professionals. And now there were people that, you know, had way more insight into this issue than I did. And they always thought it was some sort of drug hit. That there was a drug debt owed. And that's what I thought for years. Like, they probably, because they partied, y'all. I'm not trying to besmirch nobody's memory, but these people knew how to have a good time. And cocaine was a part of it. It just was. And I was under the impression that there was a drug debt and they called him to be like, hey, we need this debt paid. He was like, you know, if you got an issue with her, you need to take it up with her. And then they took it up with her. He went over there to make sure, like, wait, did they really do that? And then he went and got back in his car. I thought that for years. I felt that in my spirit based off the things I saw. But either, none of that stuff to me makes him the killer. All of my theories just don't add up to him being the killer. For me, I feel like he always knew something more than he was sharing. I don't believe his son did it. I think people who murder people did it. because they know you can't kill people that fast. Regular people who don't kill people can't kill people fast. They just don't. And they're messy. They do things that don't make sense. You know, I think he went over there to look and see, like, oh, shit, they're going to think I did it. And he ran out of there and got back home. But I don't believe he physically, you know, I just don't. I don't believe it. I'd like to actually see the full case report. I would like to see all of the evidence and then I can make an assessment. But, yeah, that's just it. But, yeah, if I'm a prosecutor, sure. I totally see it the way a skilled prosecutor, I totally see that, how a skilled prosecutor could see it that way. But without reading the case file, if they had Colombian neckties, then I definitely don't think he did it. That's just my two cents. And all of this is not based on fact. It's based on things I felt and saw for myself. Oh, and a side note. So that room where Kato was like, I heard three distinct thumps, which is not how people fall. But okay, I had run out of money a month prior. No, a year prior to that. I had run out of money, and I remember Arnell was like, hey, I can talk to my dad. He'll rent you a room for cheap if you want to live with us and not go back to St. Louis. And I was like, yeah, man. And I would have been in Cato's room. I would have heard three thumps or whatever. But I was like, dude, I don't have a car. I appreciate the offer, but trying to stay out, you guys live way out too. And you need a car in LA. St. Louis and LA are very similar, but it's LA is 100 times worse. You have to have a vehicle or you will get nowhere. So I said, cool, I'm just going to go home. So I got my first job because my parents were like, you're making $0. We paid for all this college. What the hell? So I got a job at Wash U and I started working. And I took my first vacation to LA to see my friends. So this is in, I want to say 94, because I started that job in 93. So I took my first vacation in May of 1994. So I'm visiting Arnell. I think Kim just dropped me off or Arnell picked me up or something. I don't know. Anyway, it's just the two of us. And we were in her room back behind the main house watching The Age of Innocence. And I remember it was boring as fuck. It's a Martin Scorsese, like, classical movie. Like, they had the hard wigs on. I think Michelle Pfeiffer was in it. And I was like, why isn't this good? I mean, I was literally, we were back there, like, we were knocked out. So I was like, this isn't very good. So she was like, yeah, let's go to the main house and get a snack. Said, okay, cool. Well, by the time we walked out, when we opened the door, it was pitch black. Like, it was dark. It was daytime when we went back there. So I was like, whoa. And I was in front of her and I opened the door and it was pitch black. And I think the pool was in front of me because these are pool house units. Yeah, they're by the pool. And I was like, dude, it's, I just felt something. And I stopped and I said, girl, you need to be careful back here because it's really dark. You just need to be careful. And she just said, girl, ain't nothing gonna happen back here. And like literally, a month later, the three knocks, the police, we're here to arrest your dad, all of that. Little fun fact. So anyway, that's my OJ story. And I don't take it out on his kids. Whatever you think of OJ, his kids still loved him very much, including his kids with Nicole. And his kids with Nicole, Justin and Sydney. He never lost custody of them. He never lost custody of his kids. And they love him. And Arnell helped raise them. And, you know, they love each other. And they love their dad. And I hate all of this has to happen because the media is just going to drum up the worst parts and call him all these terrible names. And, you know, he was found not guilty. If you can afford that kind of legal team, you know, and I don't know, the Kardashians, they seem like, I don't know, that trial unleashed that family on us, no doubt. They got a little taste of infamy and it was like, we can use the Kardashian name. And then like his friends think he's guilty and all, you know, they came out and said they thought he was guilty years later. I don't know. I think people really hate that OJ was always unapologetic. Guilty or innocent, you're supposed to bow your head and have your back broken. You know, I'm so sorry. But he was never like that. He was like, I ain't do it. You can't prove I did. So fuck off. Let me go play this golf. You know, and what's funny is you'll always hear these stories in the media. People were booing and hissing. And then when you talk to him, and I didn't talk to him, but I would talk to his daughter and she would be like, girl, people run up and ask for his autograph. People would be begging him and smiling at him and buying him drinks. And look, and it's like, it's crazy how the world is. Like, people take these stories like, I don't know. I'm not going to say he could walk into any room and charm people, you know, but he was not being treated like a pariah and he was unapologetic. He really was. He did not shrink away. I would have just stayed quiet and moved somewhere low key, but not him. He kept being OJ. he was an enigma, man. And I'm sorry because I like football, and it would have been nice to just talk about his football career and maybe do some comparisons. But we never could talk about football after 1994. So, but those are my stories. And again, it's all energy, just a feeling. It's just the way I felt. And you can dispute it, and you can disagree and all of that, but you can't tell me how I felt. And those were just energetic feelings, things that I was responding to in the environment, things that were so different from what I grew up like. Like, it was just all different. But one thing is for sure, Arnell is an absolutely amazing human being. I got to see her last year. We'll probably see her in the fall of this year. She's a good soul. And she loved her father. Fiercely devoted. So I'm just praying for her well-being and excited for whatever new chapter she can begin in her own life now, just as herself. And her mom's amazing too. Marguerite's really, really a fun, sweet lady. Just good people. Love them. Love them. That's it. Have an amazing day.